My name is Don DeBar, and I'm a 68-year-old New Yorker, a journalist for the past 25 years or so. Retired from my original career in the title insurance business, which is real estate and finance stuff. I started in journalism at a radio station in New York City, WBAI. It's the New York flagship of the Pacifica Radio Network, which is a lefty. Was a lefty radio network here in the United States. I frequently do political commentary for international media like Press TV, RT, and others. I've been interested and involved in politics since I was a teenager. People of my generation came up on both what was then called the civil rights movement, the human rights movement in the United States, and anti-colonial movement around the world, and the anti-war movement, particularly the Vietnam War, because people my age at the time were being drafted en masse into the U.S. military and sent over to Southeast Asia to kill or be killed.
Okay, can you just tell us why you made this transition from real estate into journalism?
I wanted to be involved in politics in one way or another since I was young, very young. And actually, it's the way I ended up in real estate was because I wanted to practice law. When I finished high school, I had sort of my fill of formal education setting for the moment. I planned to take a year or two off and then go to college and go to law school. And my mother's cousin, Peter, who's a real estate lawyer, informed me that there was a way of doing an apprenticeship by working for a lawyer for 6 years and then sitting for the bar exam that would allow me to, become a lawyer without having to go through 4 years of college and 3 years of law school. So, and make money while I was doing it. So I opted for that. And I pursued that somewhat aggressively, actually. And, unfortunately, or in any event, what ended up happening was they moved the goalposts, as they say. After my 3rd year, suddenly you had to have a year of college with, credits. So I went to do that. And while I was doing that, it became 2 years. And then it became 2 years and a year of law school. And by the time I was approaching any of that, I was making more money in the title insurance business than most of my friends who had graduated law school and gotten decent jobs in New York City were making. So I kind of just continued to pursue that. I had been, instructed in how to do legal research and, how to do the things lawyers do, and it's definitely relevant to title insurance. We're making decisions about ensuring people's ownership rights and their liens on property and such that required extensive, highly legally technical knowledge of real property law, finance, and all these related fields. And so I pursued that as a career, and in the midst of that, suddenly I found myself involved with people that were involved in politics and law and such. And so that kind of became my gateway. And I was sort of an unusual egg in that egg box, I guess. I was the one who was a communist that didn't believe in private ownership of real property, who was insuring private real property interests as a living. And I was an became an expert in property rights. That was basically the essence of what we insured. I did that for a few decades and started getting involved more in things that were closer to my heart, and I ended up finding myself in the field of journalism. And because I had already made pretty much my career, I didn't have to rely on a paycheck or a sponsor or patron as I did journalism. In other words, I was free to speak my own mind and not worry about whether or not it would sell or whether or not it would get fired for saying some, heresy or whatever.
Well, I mean,
So.
isn't it interesting because you're talking about these two networks, RT and Press TV, which the regulators, most of the countries in the West, certainly in Europe and the UK, have banned them. They've seen in their wisdom to say that these networks we're not allowed to hear. So even though you're a US journalist, for much of the Western world are not allowed to hear what you're saying on these satellite TV networks.
Yeah, it's true. And as a matter of fact, in the United States, they've made it more difficult for people to, to receive it. The U.S. has had this illusion of democracy, the illusion of Bill of Rights, and the illusion of equality and such. From really ab initio, from the beginning, the law has been pretty well settled, however, despite the fact that the Constitution, the amendment to the Constitution, the First Amendment, because it wasn't included in the original Constitution, provides for freedom of speech. The Congress shall make no law prohibiting speech, et cetera, et cetera. The law is pretty well settled that there is freedom of speech for those who own a printing press. And they have engaged then that way in that area, regulating and or constructing networks that require a certain amount of capital to participate, a number of ways where you can have formal free speech but practical monopoly on speech. And as a matter of fact, the monopoly in the United States is one that would make Goebbels jealous.
Oh, God. Well, look, we hear, certainly in the UK, my view is that you've got kind of Fox News, which is a right Republican channel, and CNN, a left Democrat channel. And in a way, the politics is completely divided in the US, whereas actually quite a lot of the key policies, like, say, for example, over Ukraine, the main parties are the two main parties, like Labour and the Tories in England, are united on a lot of this stuff.
There is at least a, I would say, a formal ideological contradiction between the Tories and Labour in the UK. Formal, like in their platform or whatever. Practically speaking, maybe it's a different matter. If you look at the positions of the, say, Blairites, for example, in Labour, and then Johnson, or this last one, and the one we just got now, or whatever, on Ukraine, on any number of things, for example, on nationalizing oil or whatever, there's a unity of opinion on the major issues between those parties. Here, that formal distinction doesn't really exist either. There are a couple of hot button issues that symbolize sort of an ideological difference. Abortion rights being one, gay marriage or LGBTQ, LMNOP rights or whatever, being another. But things that go to the heart of the political economy, who owns what, how they get to operate it, of course, existential questions of war and peace. There is little dissent at all, as a matter of fact. The most dissension that there has been from the narrative on war and peace in the United States, I would say, since at least 1980, was Donald Trump, for speaking some of the heresies that he spoke, like perhaps NATO might maybe be obsolete, and we shouldn't do these wars of regime change and nation building and such. As tepid as they were, and as many contradictions as there were in his own behavior as president, these were the only, he's an outlier, even bringing it up. And so, but the constituents of these two parties, the red cult and the blue cult, or however you want to frame it, they're at each other's throats in the streets if you give them half an opportunity. And what happens, in essence, you have MSNBC and CNN, but really MSNBC even more so, on the one hand, and I'm reluctant to call them left or right, they would be sitting in the same lap at the table during the French Revolution. They would not be on poles, opposite poles for sure, at the table. But the two cults, the constituents believe that the other are really the other, and you have Fox on one side and MSNBC and CNN on the other, in essence, holding individual televised virtual pep rallies every day, getting their particular blue team or red team all riled up for the big football game. And it has all of that, you know, it's the same kind of mindless, you know, rage that you see, you know, when an important football game or some other kind of sports match takes place. The adherents have that kind of a relationship. They couldn't tell Democrats or Republicans, including half the political organizations, couldn't tell you a damn thing, really, about actual policy.
Okay, well, look, in these midterm elections that are taking place this week, can you just explain for Brits what they are? I mean, who is actually being elected? Are most Brits, you know, we know there are elections going on in the US, but it's a bit confusing. It's not the president. It's right. Is it half the Congress or something?
Yeah, okay, so here's what happens. In the same way that you have Lords and Commons in Britain, but these are not identical structures, but in that same fashion, you have two houses of parliament and one kind of a more permanent group of individuals and the other more transient, one sort of representing the established order more and the other sort of representing the, you know, political sentiment of the moment. I mean, that's kind of the, you know, the mythology around, you know, the two houses of parliament anyway. I don't even know if anybody remembers that there because it's been so long since it was close to true. But here we have the U.S. Senate is the sort of the staid, you know, house of the establishment intended that way under the Constitution to sort of mitigate against passionate political action. And then you have the House of Representatives, which is more fluid. Okay, so beginning with the Senate, you have 100 senators. You have 50 states, quote unquote, in the United States, like New York, California, Alabama, Massachusetts, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're not states in the same sense that, say, the Czech Republic, or Moldova, or the Federal Republic of Germany, or the UK are states. They're little sub-formations within the United States of America, which is the nation state here. Each of those states, though, is a political entity that represents a constituent part of the whole based on geography. There's this chunk of land over here is New Jersey. This chunk of land over here is Florida, et cetera, et cetera. And each one of those states has two senators. No matter how many people live in it, no matter how big the real estate is, little Rhode Island and big Alaska, which has even fewer people, they have more seals, I think, than they have people in Alaska, has two senators. New York, which has 15 million people in it or something, has two senators, on and on. That's the Senate. They're in there for 6 years, and they're elected one-third every 2 years. Federal elections take place in even years. Now, the president is elected during a leap year. So the last presidential election was 2020, next one is 2024, 2028, 2032, et cetera, et cetera. With the presidential election and with the even year in between, the entire House of Representatives, who have two-year terms, go up for re-election. Now, there are 435 members of the House of Representatives as opposed to 100 senators, and they are based on population. So the most populous states, such as Texas and California, have the most members in the House of Representatives. The least populous states, such as Alaska and I don't know who else, Montana or something, have the fewest members of the House of Representatives. In fact, I think Vermont, for example, I think has only one member of the House and two senators. So every 2 years, there's an election to Congress with one-third of the Senate going up. In other words, 33 or 34 senators up for re-election, one third of the Senate, and the entire House of Representatives is up for election. Now, we had the last election in 2020 before this one, early this week, and the Democrats, who captured the White House, also captured the Senate and the House of Representatives. As a matter of fact, they had had that already. And this year, because of the multiple problems that are facing the American people, among others, and also probably consequent high unpopularity of Joe Biden, just as an aside, Joe Biden's negative numbers have been consistently now for months and months and months as high as Richard Nixon's were the day he was forced to resign. Well, the day before he was forced to resign the office, the only president in the history of the United States forced to do that. He was so unpopular, they were able to force him to resign. Biden's numbers have been that bad. His negative numbers have been that high since.
Okay, well, that doesn't really make sense, does it? If you've got a party that's negative in negative equity, if you want, you wouldn't expect to have this at all. I noticed also there were all sorts of problems with voting machines. Just last week, yeah. Biden was giving a big speech, which we carried a section of, about how important it was to protect our democracy. Then we find, oh, gosh. Less than a week later, the democracy isn't working. Voting machines are broken down.
Yeah, there's a lot here. There's a lot to unpack here. See, first of all, there's the I don't know how visible this is to people. Even here, you know, they say fish don't know that they're in water, for example, because, you know, it's all they see is water, so they don't even notice it. This part of the universe, water. Ever since, I'm guessing it was the late 2015, ever since when Trump was running for president, Trump's presidency was supposed to be a dirty trick by the Clinton campaign on Jeb Bush. I was, you know, being interviewed by people in 2014, 2015, 2016, Press TV, RT, CGTN, or CCTV was called at the time, other places. Mirror 24, a whole bunch of everybody came with, you know, this was going to be, a dynasty election, the Bushes versus the Clintons. That's what 2016 was supposed to be that. And in order to prevent Jeb Bush from running, because the Clinton campaign was nervous that he might be able to win, they floated, they helped to legitimize Trump's campaign, this has been tracked. The memos and things have all been leaked and such that they helped to float his campaign, thinking he'd be easy to beat. And as they did that, and he started saying things that, because he just kind of has always been sort of like loose-lipped, you know, whatever pops into my head, I'm going to say on TV kind of thing, started talking about the foreign policy situation, particularly. And some other things too, like the TPT, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the NAFTA deal, a number of other things, bringing back manufacturing into the United States, things that people didn't ever say because they were impossible, you're crazy, etc. And foreign policy, again, I use the word heresies. NATO is obsolete. If we're going to keep it at all, we have to make the Europeans, the Germans, and the French and everybody pay their fair share. Why are we subsidizing their militaries when they're kicking our behind in the marketplace? These things were very unsettling to whoever is the real power behind the scenes here. Clearly, no one had mentioned any of these things, even the so-called, people like Howard Dean and others that were, you know, anti-war candidates when John, Kerry ran in 2004. Nobody mentioned any of the things that Trump did. And he, instead of him, you know, going quietly into that good night because he was talking crazy, he started going up in the polls. And then they started trying to suppress him, push him away, point the microphone somewhere else. And his numbers kept going up, and he ended up getting elected. I don't know who was behind him. They had a very smart ground game. Even though they lost the popular vote, they weren't going for that. They didn't have to, because that's not how you win a presidential election in the United States. You win by getting the electoral vote, which is something else. And I could go into that if you want, but it's a peculiarity of the system. They worked the system, and he got elected. The wall-to-wall media here and in Europe, too. I mean, the BBC covers it the same way. Everything Trump did in his life, to a degree I haven't seen, you know, I've been reading newspapers here since I was 5 years old, which was 63 years ago. I never saw a media carpet bombing, incessant carpet bombing, like they did with Trump, who before this election, the 2016 election, was a darling of the media, of Hollywood. You know, if you were making a movie with Michael J. Fox, for example, as a bellboy, a bellhop in a hotel, there's a scene walking, you know, through the ballroom of the hotel or through the lobby of the hotel with Trump and his entourage. There's Donald Trump, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a Burger King commercial and you're online and Donald Trump's limo goes. But this was, you know, he didn't really go by. These were, they put him in the media, put him out front. And suddenly he was cracking at a turn, and they tried to put it to sleep. Point being this: there's been a huge, massive, and I'm going to say from left to right because that's how they characterize it. But from Fox to what they call Democracy Now, from Pacifica Radio and Free Speech TV and whatever else, the same. Trump is a fascist. His supporters are fascists. You know, this is the right wing. We need a big tent unity, von Hindenburg kind of a response to Trump to Hitler. And they ended up electing Trump because people here, by the way, didn't remember if they ever knew. Von Hindenburg won that election. And the first thing he did was appoint Hitler chancellor. anyway, I'm saying all that so that people understand that when they're looking at what's happening here in the United States, things like January 6th, the insurrection, are portrayed in a highly partisan fashion that has really little to do with the reality of the situation. And so
this is another thing, Don, that people are looking at from over here with some kind of amazement, kind of rubbing their eyes, saying, well, look, there's also been all these attempts to impeach Trump, sometimes talking about an attempt to impeach him. And this business of trying to make out that this January the 6th, after Biden was elected, was actually an attempt to seize the government. I mean, this does seem to be a bit far-fetched. And it obviously, for anybody with more than one brain cell, can work out that there's a big attempt going on here to make sure that Trump doesn't stand again and certainly never gets into that office again.
Right, I agree. I mean, what they're doing, they're trying to do a Lula on him, basically. You know, like they did in Brazil to Lula, to keep him out. You know, ultimately it failed, but they kept him out for the last 4, 5, 6 years. I don't know. I guess Dilma Rousseff would have been, you know, elected, or somebody else would have been elected because he was term limited out after his second term or whatever. And then he was allowed to run again. And then suddenly the legal problems, you know, the car wash thing and all of that. And, you know, and the point of all of that was to tag him with some criminal, you know, liability, so that he was ineligible to stand for the presidency. And he had to fight that for 3, 4, 5, 6 years. With Trump, from the minute he uttered the first heresies, we heard a tape somebody made of him in a parking lot 30 years earlier, you know, talking about women's genitalia or something. You know, I was waiting for the guy to come by on and say, I used to sit behind Trump in kindergarten and he used to pass wind. You know, it was that ridiculous, the things that they busted out. And Chuck Schumer framed it at the very beginning. Chuck Schumer said, who was the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, if I remember correctly, at the time, you know, if you're going to take on the CIA or the FBI, they have six different ways of coming at you. And so we saw this massive assault. Yeah, as far as January 6th goes, so you got the guy with the horns, and you got a dozen other people that occupy a building. So somehow you go from there to threatening the imperial power of the planet. So that I assume the next step would be the guy with the horns sits down at Pelosi's desk, picks up the phone, and orders a drone strike from the Pentagon on some enemy of his, then calls the IRS and instructs them to write a check for, you know, $500 million to his mother-in-law or whoever he feels like writing it to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, in the process of seizing control of the state, they might actually try to exercise some state power. Well, when you think of the mechanical processes involved, you realize how ridiculous that is as a proposition. But no one here challenges this narrative at all that's broad across the whole spectrum of the media. And the fact that this was an attempted coup d'etat is understood to be completely true. And any challenge to that has three or four adjectives in every statement out of every mouth that it's false, fake news, delusional, right-wing conspiracy, white supremacy somehow too, which I can't do that calculus, but...
Okay, so what do you think is going to be the ultimate result of these midterms? I mean, I know we're still counting. Where's it heading? Right.
Okay, so the reason for my bringing all of that up is to take a look at this election through that framework. First of all, in midterm elections, quote unquote, in other words, in the even year, in the congressional elections between presidential elections, when, again, the entire House of Representatives is up and a third of the Senate is up. Traditionally, if the economy is doing well or if the perception of the economy is doing well, then the party of the president does well. They maybe lose a little, but they generally retain control of whichever house or houses they had control of going in. If the opposite is true, then the opposite is true. Generally, an economy where you have what we have now, which is, at least to be kind, stagflation. People don't use that word anymore either. But this fact pattern of what we have now fits the fact pattern that they used when they made that term up in the 70s. They were predicting that, and history would predict, under normal circumstances, a major thrashing of the party in power, in other words, the Democratic Party, by the opposition party, namely the Republican Party. And the fact that it wasn't a major thrashing is now, you know, evidence of something like another piece of evidence rejecting Trump and God knows what else. But the fact of it is as follows. First of all, there have been two changes in the political operation of the political system since 2016. So the 2014 election is the last time you had the historical dynamics operating in the midterm elections. First thing is this wall-to-wall the repudiation of Trump and anyone in his faction of the Republican Party. The media here, even including Fox, the best that they get out of Fox is to be damned with faint praise. You know, well, Trump does have some good things to say. It's too bad he's such a crazy Nazi, blah, 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 blah. That's about the best you get out of them. But that is high praise compared to what almost the entire rest of the media scape does. You know, I don't think people see all the things that go on, but when Trump and Putin had their first summit, imagine if that was even possible. Back in, was it 2018 or whatever it was, 2017, 2018, in Helsinki. Because he didn't walk into the room and kick Putin in the groin and, you know, walk around like a world wrestling the fighter guy thumping his chest or whatever, then people in the New York Times, like Charles Blow, for example, called for him to be prosecuted for treason, which in the United States, I don't know what it is in the UK, carries a death penalty. to those. He was calling for Trump's execution. Now, there has been a legal framework that prohibits that since John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It was one of the first, you know, institutional responses to that after burying what actually happened, was to make it illegal to advocate for assassinating the president or the vice president, and he extended it to various other federal officials. The New York Times editorial pages carried this at the same time that one of the books that came out of nowhere and went to the top of their book list was a novel that fantasized about assassinating Trump. So he's got like a sort of an unfriendly press, and when he says some of the things he says about the press, they've earned it. And he's reporting almost as a better journalist than they are about what he's looking
at. Well, I wonder what you as a journalist made of it. I must admit, I was watching Trump at his press conferences, pointing out specific individual journalists, calling out specific individual publications and stories, and saying, yep, fake news, yep, you're fake news.
Yep.
I mean, I found that quite refreshing, actually, rather, yes, than having this kind of, where you've got a whole load of journalists almost like hanging on every single word of a politician who, for many of the viewers, they see as just liars.
Yeah, they're like, at best, they're scribes, and more often, really, they're like affirmative public relations advocates or whatever. I remember seeing a press conference, I think it was State Department, one of the flunkies over there, earlier this year, before the war started before this phase of the war started in Ukraine. And the U.S. was saying, Russia's going to invade, and Russia was saying, no, we're not, and everybody was speculating about what was actually going to happen. And there was Ned Price, or one of those lessers, at State, was peddling some nonsense without any evidence whatsoever. And Matt Lee from the Associated Press got really, he did his job very well. The guy kept trying to make unsubstantiated statements as if they were fact. And Matt would say, well, where's the evidence? And he'd say, I just gave it to you. He said, all you did was tell me. He said, well, that's it. That kind of exchange. I saw that. My jaw in my lap, because I hadn't seen that in 20 years. I mean, the last time we really had any journalism like that here in the United States, with the exception of Fox going after Bill Clinton over Monica Lewinsky, was before the first Iraq war. So we're talking 1990 or thereabouts, leading up to it. There was this major change in the media scape here. And I was in Europe twice in 1990. I was in the UK, I went to London and York, and I was in Amsterdam, and I was in Poland and Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union. I was in Kiev and Leningrad and Moscow. The press there also, we're looking at things going into this, everybody had the same narrative here. There wasn't really any opposition voice whatsoever, and that was unusual. And from there, it's only gotten worse. We had a telecommunications Act in 1996 that allowed really heavy concentration of ownership of the media, unprecedented in the history of the United States, maybe in the history of the world. The narrative has not only become almost a monotone and in unison, but simple and devoid of fact and laden with editorializing, even in the parts that are supposed to be reporting the facts. Again, I mentioned before with respect to, this is one big example. There are people that challenged the 2020 election that, they say it was rigged, that there were different problems. And there are particulars, like long lists of particulars that, are reasonable ones to raise, and I'm someone that raised these questions in the year 2000 about Bush v. Gore and that entire scenario. And I'm on the record engaging with Kerry's lawyer, who had promised he had 95 lawyers to defend his run for president in 2004. They weren't going to do what Bush did to Gore in 2000. And he did exactly that in Ohio. And I was engaging with them, trying to force the issue. You had people that were standing up in both places from the House of Representatives looking to do the allowed institutional challenge to the certification of votes that happens on January 6th. That's what was going on the day of the so-called uprising or whatever they call it, because the whole procedure for electing a president is a one-off. The people that go vote for their candidate for president don't actually vote directly for the president. They vote for people to sit in a caucus and vote for the candidate that they chose. And those people are not one-to-one for the votes that are, like, in other words, if I vote for candidate A and you vote for candidate B, and say there's 100 of me and 50 of you, it's not necessarily going to be 100 to 50 vote when it all comes out in the wash. It might be different for some proportional reasons. These sort of representatives, they call them electors, that sit in groups that they call an electoral college. There are different rules that apply to each state, and those rules are governed by the state legislatures under the U.S. Constitution. It's a federal system as far as that goes, a Confederate system, really. And so there's a procedure that they follow where first they tally the votes at the ballot box, that your vote and my vote. And then they call the people who are the electors that are assigned to each of those candidates, like the guy I voted for and the lady you voted for. They caucus in a meeting, and then they take a vote for the candidates that corresponds more or less to the popular vote. However, some states say these will be apportioned pro rata. Two votes for that guy, one vote for that guy, they come out 2-1. Other places are winner take all. If I beat you by 3 votes in the state of New York, I get all of New York's delegates. And when there's a vote of the total collection of these electors, that vote decides who's going to be president. Now, they do this from the end of November through the end of December in different stages. And then on January 6th, both houses of Congress meet in a joint session, and the product from each state, from the Secretary of State, that's sent to the Congress is brought up for a vote. Alabama. The great state of Alabama has 11 electors, all 11 for Donald, we're proud to say, for Donald Trump, the next president of the United States, like that. If one member of the House of Representatives and one member of the Senate says, I object, that's all they have to do. The two houses retire to their own chambers, and there's a trial of fact as to whether or not this vote was properly taken and was legitimate. And if both houses agree that it was not legitimate, then it's discounted. It doesn't count. That procedure has been approached several times now since 2000, including 2000. In 2000, the joint session was presided over by Al Gore. He happened to be vice president at the time, because it's before the inauguration of the next president. The vice president is the president of the Senate, and the president of the Senate presides over the joint session of Congress that meets for this purpose. So Al Gore had the gavel while people are raising objections from the House to the vote that was screwing him out of the presidency. And he asked, according to the rules, is there a senator that will join in? No senator would say yes, including himself, by the way, because he's vice president. He's not senator anymore. No senator would do it, and so he ruled the objection out of order, and that was the end of it. Automatically now that vote counts. In 2004, if I remember correctly, they had a senator that actually stood up, and they retired and then voted down. You know, the things were allowed to count. The votes were allowed to count. There was no further challenge. In 2016, you had all these politicians here saying that the Trump's election was illegitimate. I mean, this is what's hilarious now. It's a sacrilege to challenge the 2020 election. They don't even say the claim that the election was rigged, or the claim that the election was illegal or whatever. They say the false claim, that there's adjectives that go with it every time it's mentioned in the media. Look, Google it. But in 2016, these same people who now say that you're like violating a religious tenet, challenging the temple of democracy's process for electing officials, were all saying that the election was illegitimate, that the Russians rigged it, that Trump was in bed with the mafia, that a whole bunch of other stuff. And then they finally settled on the Russians. And so when they had the January 6th session, the January 6th of 2017, there were a number of Democrats that were, and some Republicans, that were willing to stand up and attempt to challenge the vote. But that didn't go anywhere either, because they didn't have the votes to actually make it happen. Well, what happened in the year 2020 that was different is that COVID was in place. There was a state of emergency because of the pandemic. There were findings of all kinds of government agencies and officials that, based on this danger to the public health, the election was a danger. We had the Democratic convention was canceled. It became a TV show for the first time in history, a badly edited one, by the way, mostly not live, poorly strung. And that was the method by which Joe Biden became the candidate, rather than the gathering of 10 or 15,000 members of the party who vote until they pick a candidate. And laws were changed in a dozen states, really, to enable voting remotely by paper ballot, rather than limiting it to the causes that they use for absentee ballots, disability, illness, whatever. The presumption was that you had a right to, because of this emergency, to vote remotely. Now, the problem with the remote voting is they're highly vulnerable to ballot box stuffing, because you fill out the ballot at home and then it wanders its way into a pile someplace where then it's counted. And the system for doing so is riddled with opportunities for fraud. And those flaws were raised when legislation was proposed in Pennsylvania and Georgia and Wisconsin and Michigan and Arizona and Nevada to allow these paper ballots, remote paper ballots, to be almost, we're going to mail them out, dear occupant. That's how ubiquitous it was. The state legislatures that were asked to do this said, no, it's dangerous. And so what happened, for example, in Pennsylvania, you had the governor issued an executive order, and the attorney general, they're both Democrats, issued an opinion saying that this was valid. And so they expanded it, and there were massive numbers of remote ballots that were sent in by mail. Well, there are a couple of problems. First of all, what everyone noticed was that although Trump was winning in Pennsylvania and Georgia and Wisconsin, and I think in Michigan too, and all he needed was two of those to win the election, as these paper ballots were delivered after the polls closed from truckloads, from the post office, and from other places people really didn't know where they came from, they were something like 8-2 in favor of Biden and pushed the election over.
Okay, well, look, so there's a possible reason for that, and that is that quite a lot of the people who would generally poorer people who might be more likely to vote Democrat find it less easy to find time during the day to vote, or yes, even maybe disabled people get to the to vote, or even as we've seen in many of the cases in the US in the past anyway, where you've got great queues in the poorer areas where people can't even get to vote, that they chose to use this system because they knew then that that way they could vote.
This is all true, quite possible. Here's the problem. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution says the federal election, including the presidential election, shall be conducted according to laws and rules determined by the state legislature. Now, the election law in those states that existed before the governor or the attorney general, or in some cases the Board of Elections, decided to change it substantially where it impacted the election. I mean, those numbers are clearly identifiable as these ballots are in this class that was created by this change, and this is the impact that they had on the outcome. That's clearly identifiable. Under Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, those changes are invalid under the U.S. Constitution. That was the basis that was going to be used. First of all, the courts would not entertain that question. And it's a fundamental one, a fundamental matter of law, which is really suspicious because they tried it in multiple states and in the federal courts, multiple district courts. And there were a million, I'll use the BS, reasons why they never got to the merits in any of those cases. You filed too early, you filed too late, you served the wrong party. Also, they call them threshold issues. When a court doesn't want to entertain something, there are a million different technical reasons why the court doesn't have to listen to the case, doesn't have to take the case. But this was wall-to-wall unanimity on this particular question. A couple of them said, we do not think the judiciary should reach in and change the outcome of the vote. But the fundamental question was, who was supposed to vote? According to the law that was adopted under the constitutional provision. So what they were going to do on January 6th was object. There were senators that said, we will join in the objections. So Arizona was the first case. It was the first state where they were going to do this. And senators said, join in the objection. Now, everyone knows that when they go to their respective chambers, and after they have the trial, in other words, they actually have a trial on the facts and law in front of TV cameras so the world can see what happened. But after they do that, there's a vote in each of the two houses, full vote. And unless both houses say we sustain the challenge, those votes are accepted. The Democrats control both houses. That no matter what the facts were or the law or how ugly it got or whatever, there was no way that they were going to vote to disallow this and let Trump become president. Everyone knew that going into it. What was intended was to lay bare the facts of what actually happened in the 2020 election so the world could see it. That's what was underway when the Capitol was breached. And instead of there being an afternoon where America watched on C-SPAN how the election was stolen in violation of the U.S. Constitution, they saw that Donald Trump's mad mob threatened the very foundation of American democracy and that he was an irresponsible player who should be banned from politics. And no one in the room should dare raise their voice given the severity of the threat to democracy that we have just experienced in this 11 and a half hour TV show that took place from when the Capitol was breached until they restored order.
Well, it's a fascinating way of looking at things. And I think for many people, you know, it would be an insight into what really goes on in US democracy. But can you tell me what you think is really going on here? Who's really running the show?
Well, that's a good question. You know, what do they say? Follow the money. I mean, oil companies and arms manufacturers are, you know, they do pretty well here. And they have a piece of everyone's tail around the planet pretty much, right? Europe certainly is certainly more beholden to American energy companies now than they were, say, 10 months ago. And it seems like this is a long-term marriage by shotgun. That's unless there's some, you know, way of reaching a modus vivendi with Russia and OPEC now, right? Unless Juan Guaido can come up with some oil. You know, let's look at this election, because I've kind of done all this to set that up, and I think that'll help answer the question you just asked. Because of all of these things, rather than Democrats getting a rout, there was a chunk of the vote that bought into the narrative that there is an existential threat to democracy in the United States, represented by Trump and that faction of Republicans, and consequently, they you can't vote for them. Biden said it. A whole lot of them said it. This democracy is on the ballot. Some people believed it. Now, the actual campaign, when you have World War III going on, and forget whether or not we're going to have a nuclear war, we spent more money in Ukraine than we spent on any war in history before. In that period of time, we've spent more than the annual Russian military budget on Ukraine. We've spent more than the annual housing and urban development budget on Ukraine. We spent more than the annual food assistance program in the United States in Ukraine. We spent more than that. So, and this is at a time when food security, housing security, medical care security, college debt, these are all record, burdens on the population. And this is, 40 years into austerity, just like in Europe. And so there's a whole, set of fundamental problems that were completely left out of the political narrative for this election, which was about democracy and abortion and LGBTQ rights. And yet, with all of the unanimity of opinion across the media, and with all of the data that they were able to gather from all the social media over the last 20 years and bring to bear on the problem, the Democrats did lose the House. There was a cluster of maybe 75 to 80 now Republican members of the House of Representatives who have no intention of funding Ukraine one step further. They are going to be a significant voice in picking the next Speaker of the House. And it's going to be a significant issue for them. There are some changes that I think we're going to see regardless of what happens in the Senate. And it may well be after the runoff election in Georgia, because there's a runoff election coming in Georgia, that the Republicans will have control of both houses. You can look at the Clinton presidency as an example of what happens when the other party has control of the Congress. The same with Obama, I think even more so because there are some fundamental questions of international policy that there's some deep disagreement between the mainstream Republicans or formerly mainstream Republicans and the Democrats and the intelligence community and the media on the one hand, and on this new group of Republican insurgents, and on the guy who's leading in polls for presidency in 2024, Donald Trump, on the other hand.
The Republicans are set to take over, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
But what about this business of voting machines? Is there anything going to be done about actually making sure the voting system works?
The whole thing. So we've had this problem really since the late 18th century. There has been every kind of scam imaginable around the simple process of counting the vote. And after the famous Hanging Chads disaster in Florida in 2000, that obviously swung the election from Al Gore to George W. Bush, the remedy, which was called the Help America Vote Act, was supposed to be modern, computerized tallying of the vote. You go in, you push the buttons like you do on a cash machine, and it tallies your vote as accurately. You can't go into a cash machine and take out more money than you're entitled to, can you? So don't worry about the security of the voting machines. That was the rap that we got. Then when we said, well, you know, it doesn't seem right. Exit polls say this, and your official tally says that. Could you show us an audit trail? We find that generation of machines had none. That we had to take on faith what happened inside this black box was an accurate count. And, of course, we found by testing it that it wasn't that at all. And these things were ripe for fraud and probably hiding an awful lot of it. And then they went to a system of scanning paper ballots. So you get a sheet of paper and you black out what you want to do on it. And you run it through a scanner. And the first count is done by computers. But if there's a challenge to it, they preserve the paper ballots. And you can do a hand count audit of the tally. And this is supposed to make it transparent. Well, as it turns out, as a matter of fact, there are an awful lot of ways that you can scam that process as well. I could go through some of them if you want, but suffice to say, you can fool that system too. Then there are the more conventional ones that go back even to the date of the mechanical voting machines that used to calculate sort of like with a built-in abacus, more or less. That would punch cards or make an imprint on a piece of paper with an ink roll. And that was that about halfway through the day, some official-looking guys with an official-looking truck roll up and swap out the machine. Well, this one's done, and they bring another one. And everybody that voted that morning, the vote didn't come out right, that vote didn't get counted. And the new machine, nobody knew if it really opened up at zero or not. It might be that my guy already had 100,000 votes on this machine before they turned it on. So there's all kinds of, you know, mischief-making opportunities if you want to make mischief. And there were all kinds of reports of voting machine outages in some key places, like where the capital of New Jersey is, as one example. Places that were considered swing districts within the state. And in some of them where the outcome was contrary to what both the exit polls said and also what the preliminary polling had indicated. Now,
is there any evidence then in the US over the last decade or so of the serious electoral abuse of these voting machines?
Matter of fact, in 2004, so we're going back 18 years, a gentleman named Nick Mottern, M-O-T-T-E-R-N, enlisted me and a number of other people to review a bunch of evidence that they had collected in Ohio, both in terms of testimony on videotape, affidavits, and then actual mechanical evidence from machines and work product from machines that the vote was stolen in Ohio, in Columbus, and a couple of other places. And we put this stuff together while the process that I described before was going on. So the election was in November. This is like in December when it's still before it's finalized, January 6th. And we took it to the FBI office because it's a federal crime to tamper with elections and it's federal jurisdiction. So you can take it to any FBI office. And we happened to know where the one was where we are. And we happened to both live here and we had all the work here. So we took it there. And that was the first time, and they refused to see us after we told them why we wanted to see them. And so we left. We held a press conference. The second time, we held a press conference before we went in from outside, and we had the press come in with us, along with a dozen people who were carrying signs and stuff. Anyway, it took us a week of doing this in the snow, by the way. It was early December, mid-December, before they finally took the complaint. That was the end of it. We never heard anything back after they took our envelope.
Well, that doesn't sound very good, does it? So ultimately, I suppose, we've got in the West is we've got all these democracies, including the UK, big inverted commas over that word. lecturing the rest of the world and saying, well, actually, we're going to invade X, Y, and Z to make it safe for democracy. Well, it right. does seem a little bit hypocritical. Yeah. I wonder, just, you know, finally, can we just wind up by looking ahead with the results, and I wonder how the results of these elections might affect foreign policy? Because, you know, certainly we in Europe, many people look at the US saying, well, foreign policy is just some sort of game that the American politicians play in order to try and win vote and affect their own domestic population, whereas the rest of the world has to suffer this.
Yeah, I think it's more than that, because look, the reason for demonizing Russia, there may be political, you know, capital. Hillary Clinton gets to blame somebody for losing, whatever. But there's also that other reason that compelled Napoleon and Adolf Hitler and their lessers in that fashion, since 1917, certainly. That is, as Hitler wrote himself, looking at the path to greatness for Germany to build his thousand-year Reich. All the other colonies have been taken. Africa is divided. Britain, France, Spain, etc. Latin America, Asia. Where is the last frontier where we can get an unlimited amount of raw materials and an unlimited supply of labor to develop them? Russia, look east. There's still huge reserves of just about everything. And it's the only possible thwart to absolute hegemony for the elite that runs pretty much everything else. If Russia's not there, China is engaging in an entirely different way. They got to play the long game. So foreign policy here is not just to play to the rubes at home, but rather has its own intrinsic value for the elite here, and it's even of an existential nature. And so we're looking at, first of all, a contradiction among the elite. I don't know how it plays out. I don't want to get into some long theoretical discussion of that. I mean, I'm glad to, but I know you want to wrap this up. But suffice to say that there are some who think that perhaps there's another path other than global hegemony and or war to achieve that. And some of those are looking to find expression in policy. And it may well be that this election will provide that. That's the first thing. Secondly, just in the internecine struggle between the blue crooks and the red crooks, okay, the blue crooks have pilloried the red crooks for the last 4 or 5 years with all kinds of investigations and hearings and attempted impeachments and all of this, and taking testimony from people and perjury convictions and whatnot. Well, now the shoe is on the other foot, as they say. And so you can bet that people with the blue shirts are going to be dragged in front of, you know, this or that star chamber hearing and asked, if you now have or ever been, blah, 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 questions like the red shirt people had to answer for the last 4 or 5 years. You're going to see those things happen, I think, almost guaranteed.
Can you just give us any idea of the best way for people to follow you and your work, and also recommend other journalists, books, etc., that you think actually do make a real effort to get to the truth? Because as journalists, we're sometimes persuaded that actually there is no truth, and actually that you just have to simply say what you're told to say, etc. But I mean, I believe that if you work at it, you work hard enough, you will find out what's really going on. Yeah. So can you just give us a few pointers in that direction?
First, the media outlets. One of the problems Americans have, which we're trained, for lack of a better word, to pick which one is telling the truth and then listen to them, and then we'll know the truth. And of course, life is not like that at all. The first thing is I would look at everything that you see critically, and then try to have as many sources that are as close to the actual information as possible. Out of the available media outlets, my personal experience is that places that have a diversity of opinion, a real diversity of opinion, not for show, but in substance, are the was robust Those are the best places to start looking to understand what's going on. You may not find out exactly what's going on there, but you're going to get a hell of a lot closer to it than you are with somebody just giving one point of view, but with absolute certainty all the time. So Press TV impresses me that way, for example. There are people there that I agree with most of the time, and people there that I disagree with most of the time, and a tolerance among those in the main for each other and for other opinions. I have never had anyone there, for example, try to tell me what to say or not say or to stay away from or anything like that. I speak entirely what I want there. And I would say that and RT, I've had that experience with, and I think it's very unusual in the mediascape to have that experience, first of all. Secondly, I like to look at the actual source stuff. And, you know, there are people like Eva Bartlett, others who are on the ground pointing their camera at stuff so that when they say, this blew up yesterday at 3:00, there it is. You know, and that was a baby that got killed by this incoming thing or whatever, and it came from over there, which is where the Ukrainians are, instead of the mealy-mouthed garbage that we get from, commercial media here. So
it's something close to the ground. It's often military press releases. They're just reading out.
And CIA, too. CIA the Board of Broadcast Governors here in the United States, but same thing. They have this huge media apparatus that we pay for, but it was supposed to be targeting our quote-unquote adversaries, beaming democracy into them and enlightenment or whatever. And as it turns out, and they were forbidden to beam it back at us because it seemed kind of scary and a little dystopic to be forced to tax to pay for somebody to BS you with your own money. But Barack Obama did away with the firewalls, the post-firewall for that. And now what's the things that are constructed by the propagandists for the U.S. government are actually the material for the commercial media here. They don't need to have their own people write the stuff anymore. It comes in on the wire, or over the internet from Langley.
I know I said finally, but other question occurs to me you might like to address, and that is this. There's a lot of people saying that there are, at the very top levels, quite a lot of links between China and the US, particularly through the Biden family. And what do you make of that? Some others saying, well, of course, China and the United States are completely separate, utterly opposed. And there is this kind of almost like super elite Kissinger element that it does suggest there may be some actually quite a lot of the technology, particularly surveillance, public control technology, being trialed in China. There are elements in the US and maybe Europe too that are looking at this gleefully.
You know, there are a lot of ways of looking at this thing. The real world, first of all, there's no saints and there's no demons. You know, there's a lot of people, a lot of greedy ones, a lot of sociopathic ones, a lot of organized, groupings of people that have their own dynamics, and they can be pretty unhealthy for the bulk of us, the operations of these things. You know, looking at the history of the relationship between China and the Soviet Union and or Russia and the United States, you have the tripolar diplomacy that was used to basically break up the socialist bloc. And China became a willing partner in that, trading, solidarity with the rest of the socialist bloc for its own development. On the one hand, you could make a moral judgment about that you betrayed the socialist bloc, et cetera, and you're not really socialist. On the other hand, you can make an argument, well, actually, I'm really a Marxist, and you can't have communism without the material basis, and this is the only way we're going to be able to build it. There's all of that stuff floating around in the background. There are a lot of things, a lot of markers that people point to, friends. Some of the people I respect the most, as a matter of fact, will remind me that in terms of vaccination, that, Cuba and Russia and China all, even more aggressive than the United States, that China, of course, they gladly took all of the industry that belonged to the oligarchs here and now you know, are basically partners with them, 5149 or whatever, you know, in all of that. And I engage in that conversation and sometimes sort of mischievously say that, you know, a war between Russia and China then would be a fight over 2% of the stock. Is that what, a hostile takeover? Is that what World War III is going to be? You know, there's a lot of things to parse through all of that. And frankly, for us, they're unknowable. I don't really know who's behind any of this. Our contact with most of these things is virtual. I mean, we're just talking about how to see the truth, and I'm saying get as close to the ground as you can. How do you get close to the ground behind who the decision makers are in the Chinese Communist Party, in Langley, at Wall Street, like the real people? You know, that's one of the things that I point out to people, you know, about 500 years ago, even 100 years ago in Russia, you have a revolution. You know who the king is. You know where he lives. You go to the palace. You drag him out. You cut off his head. You spread his body to the four winds. And now you're in power. You know who it is and what to do. Who do we do that to now? Do you have any idea which person?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if you're looking into this, you could probably start in that funny little old lab in Wuhan, couldn't you? Anyway, listen, John, it's fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us. But could you just wind up with your social media so people are able to follow you if they want?
Okay, so if you want to find me, please don't shoot me. right now, I'm on Facebook. It's Don DeBar, DONDEBAR. But I can't respond right now except to text because I'm in Facebook jail yet again. I'm also on VK.com. That's like VictorCarl.com. That's sort of a Russian English language Facebook style platform. Much freer, much more sane, much more substantive conversation there. Not so many bots and other, you know, annoyances. I'm also at Don DeBar on Twitter, and I have a YouTube page under Don DeBar that I've got a few hundred videos going back 25 years or so of different things I've worked on.
Okay, Don, from the Citadel of the Dying Empire, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Tony. I appreciate it.